Coming up on Harvard Chan This Week in Health, climate change and our health.
When you change the climate, you sort of change the rules of a game for human civilization.
In this week's episode, an in-depth conversation about the effects of climate change and the steps we can take to reduce the damage. Hello and welcome to Harvard Chan This Week in Health. It's Thursday, February 16th, 2017. I'm Noah Levitt.
And I'm Amy Mountemuro. In this week's episode, we'll be sharing an in-depth conversation on the health effects of climate change.
And this will be the first in a multi-part series looking at links between climate change and health. I recently sat down with Ari Bernstein, who is Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard Chan School, and also a pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital. In this week's episode, we speak about what we know about the health effects of climate change and what can be done to mitigate those effects. And in the second half of our conversation, which you'll hear next week, we spoke specifically about communicating about climate change and strategies to reach those who may be skeptical about the effects. In future episodes, we'll be looking specifically at how climate change may affect our food supply and even mental health. But for now, here's part one of our conversation with Ari Bernstein. You're a pediatrician, but also you work over the Center for Health and the Global Environment. So can you talk about kind of how you kind of came into environmental health, studying the effects of climate change?
I was exposed to climate change as a scientific problem relatively early on. And it was compelling because people were saying that by changing the composition of the atmosphere, we were going to change the climate. And when I went to medical school, I was thinking that this has got to matter to people's health. At that time, relatively few people were engaged. But it was apparent then, as it is now, that climate change has vast implications for our ability to lead healthy lives. And as a pediatrician, you know, our job is essentially to keep kids healthy and mostly to prevent kids from getting sick. So there was really a natural pairing between being a pediatrician and thinking about climate change in the same way that, you know, I give kids vaccines to prevent disease. I would like to prevent our kids from experiencing the ills of climate change. And those are preventable in many cases.
And so you just touched on it there, the ills of climate change. So what do we know now about what some of the health effects of climate change are?
We know enough to know that reducing greenhouse gas emissions is the most cost-effective strategy to preventing health outcomes that we don't want. And the way I think about the health effects of climate change is that they really affect all of the great progress we have made in dealing with nutritional problems, infectious problems, in some cases mental health. And that's because when you change the climate, you sort of change the rules of a game for human civilization. So, you know, we've only grown food for ourselves for about 10,000 years. That's occurred because the climate of the Earth is where it is now. And we're pushing ourselves out of that envelope. So we're changing the game for how we grow food. Carbon dioxide, as Sam Myers and others' research here at the school has shown, carbon dioxide itself affects the nutritional content of plants. We change the way infectious diseases work. There is no pathogen that isn't in some ways temperature sensitive, and especially vector-borne diseases. There's the prospect that climate change will destabilize where those infections can happen. Now, there's a lot of other things can affect where infections do and do not happen. There used to be malaria in Washington, D.C. There isn't anymore. That's not because the climate has done anything but warm since it was eradicated there. But nonetheless, particularly in places of the world where they're least able to adapt. The other thing, of course, is sea level rise. You know, lots of people live near the coast. People are moving to the coast. At the same time, sea level is rising. And one of the areas in which climate science has been particularly clear is on the accelerating rate of sea level rise as we learn more about the melting of ice sheets in Greenland and in Antarctica. So really, across the board, climate change has effects upon health. But again, it's quite clear that if we want to do a really powerful thing when it comes to protecting and improving people's health, we would do well to reduce our use of fossil fuels, to increase our rates of active transport, bicycling, walking, so forth, and really get a win-win in a sense. We get short-term benefits from air pollution. We get long-term benefits from greenhouse gas emissions.
And so just to jump off of that, you gave this interview with Harvard Public Health Magazine, and I believe the quote was, "Reducing greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere may be the greatest public health intervention ever. And you just touched on it there. You mentioned how it's cost-effective. So can you explain a little bit more about why focusing on reducing greenhouse gas emissions is such an effective public health intervention?
A lot of the health outcomes are clear in the sense that we can anticipate they will happen, but their magnitude is really hard to know. And infectious disease burdens, vector-borne disease is a good example of that. Even to a certain extent, nutritional outcomes, if we're having a harder time growing food because there are droughts or heat waves, we can see those things happening. We're not entirely sure how that's going to translate into nutritional outcomes, but if you're a gambling person, you're probably not going to bet that climate change is going to be good for either the spread of vector-borne diseases or nutritional outcomes or a host of other things. And so then you get into this math about, is it cost effective to do something now? And one of the big arguments that stands out about whether we should be doing more to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions is that it's not cost effective. It's going to cost too much. Well, that's an accounting problem. And we're stumbling on an economic model that essentially says we can only count what we have counted. And if we can't count it, it doesn't really matter. And, I get that, but it also is essentially pitting the present moment against the future. And as a physician, what we're doing makes no sense, because if I saw a child come to see me at Children's who, was, say, 2 weeks old and had a fever and, had been exposed to, as many kids this time of year are, lots of people with colds, I don't presume that that child has a cold and will get better. No, we know from experience, we have some reason to believe that there's a very small percentage of kids who will have a potentially life-threatening infection. And so we act in the likelihood that that will be reality. We do everything we can to find that infection, and we treat with antibiotics presumptively before we know the infection is there. If it turns out in a couple of days that there's no sign of infection, we stop the antibiotics, kid goes home. Well, that's sort of the analogy here, which is that we don't know for sure how severe the health consequences are going to be. We have ample reason to be concerned, and we have technologies that can substantially move us off fossil fuels rapidly, and we're not using them as much as we might because people are saying it's not cost effective in this limited sense of cost effectiveness. So, when this issue of the greatest public health intervention ever, if sea levels rise by as much as 10 feet, we're talking about tens of millions of people who are going to be displaced. Those people, if you find people who have been forced to move against their home, forced against their will to move from their homes, they have some of the worst health status in the world. Think about people displaced by Katrina or the Syrian refugees across the board. So that population of itself would be an enormous issue. But then you think about the nutritional piece. So we had a massive heat wave in Europe a few years ago. It burnt about a quarter of the Russian wheat crop. Russia stopped exporting food, and there were global price spikes in food. And that caused food riots in Mozambique and people's ability to get access to food, because a lot of the poorest countries in the world are net food importers. They don't grow enough to feed their own populations. You think about heat waves and the predictions around heat waves, and on and on and on and on. Again, I think one of the stumbling blocks here is that there are a lot of people who feel that we don't have enough certainty to do more, or that the economic equations don't pan out enough. And that, both of the, on the first issue, I would say we know well more than enough to be doing more in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, even from a health standpoint. Forget about the economic arguments, by the way, which are also significant, or the national security arguments, which are also profound. And on the math thing, you know, even the economists, you know, they use this thing called a discount rate, which is essentially how much you value money in the future. Whether or not this is cost effective, even with the limited understanding of the health costs that we have, like the ones we can actually put numbers on, even with that, it's simply a matter of what discount rate you choose and how much you think the future is worth compared to the present. And there are vast arguments over that. But to me, to play devil's advocate, the argument is that if we spend too much now to move away from fossil fuels, it could be damaging to our economies at the present. I think that that's a rational argument, but it belies the reality that you would be hard-pressed to think about a more cost-effective time, even with technologies becoming less expensive, because of the long atmospheric half-life of carbon dioxide. This stuff is going to be around for a very long time. And even if we went cold turkey on carbon emissions today, there would still be increases in CO2 through the century that would cause effects. So again, we have a hard time doing accounting here. As a physician, I look at the situation and say, I would never treat a patient this way. No one as an individual would accept being treated this way. They would never say there's a potentially small but real probability of civilization being undermined. And us saying, well, it's a little too expensive right now to do anything. No one would say, you know, it's a little too expensive to have your appendectomy right now. Let's wait a little while and see if that's a good idea. So that's sort of what we're doing here. Some people are thinking in this realm, and it just doesn't make sense when you really scratch below the surface.
Are there any kind of big unanswered questions when it comes to climate change and health, or is it more a situation where we know what the health effects are? The unanswered question is how severe they'll be or when we'll start to see these effects.
So there's two sides to that coin. We can always try and learn more about the specific health outcomes. That's going to be really hard. And again, in this analogy with the baby who comes in with a fever, you know, it's going to be hard for us to make precise estimates of health outcomes, aside from maybe heat and potentially sea level rise. A lot of these things are hard to model in ways that you can get clear answers. But I do think in the debate about cost effectiveness and policy, we can do much more to understand the health benefits in the near term from things that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So we've done a little bit around air quality. Some of the research has come out of the school. Jonathan Bunikor and Joel Schwartz in particular have been involved looking at how many lives would be saved if the clean power rule that was set forth in the Obama administration were implemented. It's thousands of lives a year in the United States. But, you know, we haven't even touched things like food waste. So we throw away, you know, a quarter, potentially more of the calories produced. Those calories all have greenhouse gas embedded in them, but they also have water. They also have fertilizer that runs off into our rivers and pollutes waterways. And there's all the equipment that's putting out fossil fuel-based pollution. So there are whole suite of co-benefits there, from water consumption and, you know, scarcity fresh water pollution, to air pollution, and potentially even to caloric insecurity, right? So in places of the world where calories are really scarce, if we're still wasting lots of food, you know, if we reduce that, there will be benefits to nutrition. If we got a better handle on those things and could put monetary values on them, then they can be put into these deliberations on, is it cost effective to reduce, you know, carbon dioxide emissions? But without any of that quantified, it becomes hard to do that. So we've got food waste as an issue. We've got active transport. We've got dietary changes. We've got a whole host of these so-called co-benefits, which if we were better able to get a number on the benefits, those benefits, we could include them in conversations about whether we should be doing more right now. And I think that is one of the biggest areas we need research in right now.
That was part one of our conversation with Ari Bernstein on the health effects of climate change. Coming up next week, how can we communicate more effectively about climate change?
This is a view of the world in which we live for tomorrow, but not for our children.
How did climate change become such a polarizing topic? What can be done to change that? And why empathy might be the key to shifting the conversation.
If you're interested in learning more about climate change and its effects, we have a page of resources for you. You'll find a link on our website, hsph.me/thisweekinhealth.
And that's all for this week's episode. I'm Noah Levitt.
And I'm Amy Montemuro. A reminder, you can always find this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher.